Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Maron to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Maron at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
I'm feeling really grateful today for education.
Oh yeah, why?
Well, I've been thinking about ways of coping, like coping mechanisms that people are all putting into place now that we've been put into lockdown. Mm. And I think one of the great things that I've been able to use so far is the idea of education. And I don't necessarily mean like traditional education, because I know that there's kids all over the country who now have lessons like through computers and are actually having traditional education in a new way. But I meant more like kind of personal education in the sense of like either reading books or a kind of thirst for knowledge. And the guest we're going to speak to today is somebody that I think has actually educated me a lot through her program at the gallery that she runs. And I've learned so much about lots of different kind of social issues thanks to the artists that she's given a platform to and then has gone on to represent. And I'm really grateful for that, because I feel like at this time we need ideas more than ever as a way of somehow keeping ourselves encouraged and uplifted and inspired, which is also why I'm so happy that we're able
to continue the message. Ideas are needed to continue the stories and the messages that we all need more than ever now.
Definitely, yeah. So we would like to welcome to this very special quarantine talk art,
Rosa Farkash.
Hi.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm very well, thanks.
How are you finding it? Are you in lockdown at home?
No, I came to my grandma's about almost 2 weeks ago already, so I've been quarantining for a lot longer. I just knew that I would get really, really depressed if I was on my own, and I didn't really want her to be on her own either. So
where are
I came,
you?
The Midlands, in a little village called Ropsley. So quite glad. I think I like maybe came here 10 days after they put the like law lockdown in. So I'm feeling like that was quite a smart move.
And yes,
I have to say a little bit relieved about that.
Are you able to work remotely there?
I feel for everyone in London. Yeah, I am. I am, which is lucky. I'm super privileged in that regard. Also, at the moment, it's not so much work. It's kind of like action stations of figuring out what support is out there, you know, for businesses like mine. And kind of like strategy of like how we're going to be working moving forward, because things are going to change for quite a while, I think. So the kind of daily work that I would normally do is kind of different at the moment anyway, you know. Right.
So normally your daily work, so you run a gallery called Arcadia Missa, which you started as a project space in 2011 in Peckham.
Yeah.
And then it moved to Soho in 2014?
No, we stayed in Peckham for a while, but around the end of 2014, we started to represent artists and changed to be a commercial gallery. I mean, it definitely the first year was more figuring that out or testing it out, and then kind of more in earnest halfway through 2015, I guess. But we moved to Soho 2018, yeah. So it's
and how was
two,
that?
Two
how
years.
Was that move?
I think it's been really good. Like, actually, the like horrible London commute pre-corona times, I think, has been quite good for me, getting myself into work mode. But also just, you know, London's so spread out. If you're in the centre, everyone can get to the centre, so to visit. And people that are, like, international and stopping in London, they can visit. Whereas a lot of the time, if people are coming for London to see art for 2-3 days, they're not going to make it down to Peckham. So,
Also, I think it's good to have a routine, isn't it, in some sort of sense of going to work, sort of leaving your home.
100%. Yeah.
It's good psychologically.
Yeah, that's why I've tried to keep a strict routine whilst I'm here and, like, and doing, like, a Monday to Friday.
You're doing, like a 9-to-5?
Yeah. Well, actually, no. I'm doing 10 till 4 because, you know, me and my gran have to, like,
breakfast,
do fun stuff. Yes. Yeah, do breakfast and fun stuff in the afternoon together and stuff like that.
How is she doing? How is she finding? I mean, what does she make of your career, your the art world?
I just had to explain to her what podcast was before this. And she...
Oh, I love her.
She thought it was incredible, so I think you're going to have one new listener, because she does have an she does have an iPad.
That'd be three listeners. My mum, your granny. Brilliant.
yeah. Step by step. Yeah.
Incremental. Yes.
She was like, because she's got an iPad, and she was like, so can I get this on my iPad? Because I was explaining what apps are on phones, because she doesn't have a mobile phone, and that everyone, you know, and it's kind of like radio, but it's maybe what happened to journalism and it became more independent, but now even the big radio stations do podcasts. Blah, blah, blah. She's like, can I do that then on my iPad? She's like, yeah. And then brought the iPad over, and then she kind of opened it all up, and now the world of possibilities are at her fingertips.
Oh, that's
so
amazing.
Yeah.
And what is she making the art world of your world? Did she come down to London and see the shows?
She never made it to Peckham. Rude. But she did make it to Soho. And I think it was basically, I just got so lucky because Bill Nighy came to the opening that she came to.
No way.
Yeah. So she literally, and my mum was there as well. So, like,
you looked like you were legit.
I looked like the coolest person in the world. they both like, I mean, I think all three of us were like, oh my God, we fancy him so much. But it's, you know,
love
he's
Bill
kind
Nighy.
Of, he, yeah, legend. He's one for all generations, yes, you know.
He's so good. He's such a good actor.
Yeah, he's lovely as well. And so that was...
What was the opening? Who was it?
Do you know, this is really bad. I can't remember. I was just so overwhelmed by Bill Nighy. It might have been Phoebe Collins-James, actually.
Right. Is he a collector?
No, he lives in Soho.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
oh,
so
yeah,
she was,
does,
like,
yes,
doing something to the gate or something, because where the gallery, it's kind of like round, you've got to go through a gate on Brewer Street and then round the back, and it's quite hard to find. So it's not like you walk past and it's like, oh, what great art, let me go and have a look. But Ruth was down there, and I think she was just like, hi, you're Bill Nighy, do you want to come to the opening? Something along those lines. Mm-hmm.
Like, brilliant.
And... So that, because no one in my family works in the arts, right? So that's a really good, like, barometer of, like, legitimacy for them. So
yes,
it was the perfect timing for him to come to the gallery. So I will forever be in his debt, because
that's quite
my family think
thought.
I do have a job.
That's quite an interesting thought as well, because if you think about when you were in doing the kind of non-profit era of your gallery in Peckham in South London, it was very much about a kind of local community of artists and writers and, you know, creative people in a way that came together.
Yeah.
So it's can you talk a bit about that time, but then also how that's now evolving now that you're in Soho, which is obviously a completely different community, which obviously Bill Nighy is part of.
Me and my mate Bill.
BN, yeah.
I will say I'm really glad to be in Soho if we ever go back to actually being physically in Soho. But you know, the space is significantly different to where it was in Peckham. Like, it is a tenth of the size, literally a tenth of the size for the same price. Like, it's really, really small. Mm-hmm. So that, and plus a lot of my kind of immediate community or network, you know, things have changed a lot in London. A lot of the artists and writers and stuff have moved to different cities. So I think when Arcadia Missa was a project space, because I guess we were all younger, so we had like less responsibility, more time on our hands maybe, but also London was an easier city than it is now. A lot of us were more living locally to each other. Mm-hmm. The space had the capacity to be a place of a kind of informal assembly. And, you know, there'd kind of, you know, something would maybe happen, or, you know, or like there might be kind of like a letter of demands within the art world about something. And it would be something that we would be like, oh, let's all meet here and like talk about it and have some food. And, you know, so it was, there was a lot of kind of just conversation happening outside of the conversation that was part of the public program and stuff, just because of
like the community part of the community.
Well, yeah. And like a lot of that came from the people that, you know, I was at art school with, but also just generally like artists in London, basically. And the space could facilitate that. And the proximity of people actually living near enough to each other within London could facilitate that. And then, you know, a lot has changed since then. People that have stayed in London, they're further away, you know, mm-hmm. like they're like, you know, I'm in Peckham, someone's in Walthamstow. It's like mm-hmm. a lot more spread out mm-hmm. Because of rent costs. So that plus kind of growing up and Soho being expensive and having, you know, and it becoming a commercial gallery instead of a project space has meant that I guess a lot of the conversations, they're maybe more formalised in the publications, and that kind of space of talking together happens a lot less, you know. But I think I'm glad that the publications have continued that kind of like self-organised discourse,
yes.
if you like.
And publishing's always been a really sort of major central concern for you, hasn't it? As well
yeah.
as doing an exhibition program. I feel like that's kind of what I was alluding to in the introduction about education, because
yeah.
I think that's something that was also quite unique to your vision in a way for what you wanted to, you know, contribute and add to the art world in a way.
Yeah. I think that more and more like self-publishing in the visual arts has increased as kind of the technology and cost and like ability to do it is easier and cheaper. And like a lot more artists kind of will, you know, make their own scenes and stuff. And artists have always done this. And I think galleries have always done catalogues. And because I was a project space and because of these kind of in informal but really interesting critical conversations that were happening, because of wanting to put though it yeah it not being a gallery, it being a project space, the publications kind of were quite natural. But then they continued in a very like in the same structure when it became a gallery, rather than changing then into catalogues, just because I don't know, I just like it, and yeah, I don't really know why. It's just I think a really, really important part of Arcadia Missa, and it's a way also of giving a platform to artists that maybe I don't have the capacity to represent, but I also really love their work, you know.
Right, right.
It does a lot. It does a lot of things, but I think a lot of galleries are doing more alternative publications now. I think we just had maybe just had like a system of it like from the start, and we had like lots of different threads, like the journal, the anthologies, the artist novellas. Like it's kind of like a quite an active publishing program that can stand alone, separate from the gallery as well. Rather than just being like documentation of what we do at the gallery.
I always found it really interesting as well, the kind of topics that those publications and also your exhibition program would encompass. Like I feel like it's very political in some ways, but also, you know, about bringing about social change through creativity and art. So you kind of, your artists that you're interested in would look at like gender, I don't know, like identity politics, LGBTQ rights, you know, all kinds of different issues that are very specific in a way to, I think, what your program is, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I think, I mean, if you're going to run your own small gallery, then like, especially because I did it, the project space straight out of art school. So I never really learned how to run a gallery by working in a gallery before, which would have been a better idea, I think, with hindsight. But anyway, because of that, I think the I mean, there's pros and cons both ways in it. But like, it's one of those things that it is a lot of work, and there is, you know, like, you're basically anything you're making, you're putting back into the gallery. So it's like, on, you know, I'd be in a much better position if I was working for another gallery, probably, you know. However, the privilege is I can show whatever I want. It's my gallery, you know. And it just happens that these are the things that I'm interested in. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't kind of like a clear agenda, but it's out of just selfishness of, well, I want to show what I want. I'm in, this is what I'm interested in. And it's just kind of happened like that. And I think that, you know, you can't really compromise on your interests, you know, unless you're kind of going into it as a business. And I think most gallerists aren't, you know. They're not doing, like, that's not where they start galleries.
Can we talk about the name Arcadia Missa? What does that mean? Where does it come from? Who?
No.
Why? Yes. No. You've got to admit it.
No, I hate you.
No. What does it mean?
I can't. It's so embarrassing.
Come on.
No, just leave it as like a it just sounds really cool, right?
Cryptic.
Just let's...
sound cryptic.
Why are you embarrassed? Why have you never changed your name then?
Oh, because that's long, isn't it? Like, how can you actually think up, like, thinking of a name? Oh, God. It's literally, oh, God.
Come on.
I hate you right now.
Good.
Okay, well, moving on from that then.
No, she was about to do it, Rob. You was about to really? Tell us. Come on, we need it.
Briefly, okay, so Arcadia is obviously this pastoral utopia. Bear in mind the idea of it was a very art school. Like, I was at art school, you know. I was, like, young.
Tom Stoppard wrote Arcadia. Is it based on that? Like, their utopian?
No. It's just that. And Missa is Holy Mass. And obviously, a staple of art school is, you know, Inside the White Cube, and the ideas of kind of the there is this kind of fallacy of the gallery as being this transcendental space, you know. So basically it's kind of like, it's a very heavy name. Like, it's like Pastoral Utopia, Holy Mass. Like, it's extra, like, very, very extra. and it's also, you know, when I got the first space, it was a railway arch. So it really wasn't a white cube. And it's very much like this idea of, like, oh, so special. And I think also that's probably why I have, like, the history of Arcadia Missa is that there's a lot of kind of discussion and publications and stuff, because actually it's this, the gallery or the art object, maybe it isn't a magical thing, but maybe the context that can pass through it really is of value or something. I don't know. There's still some art objects that I think are magic. So
what would you call it now then? If you were starting now, what would you call it?
Jesus. I think it's really hard. Okay, I have this theory. There's three ways of naming a gallery, right? Mm-hmm. There's naming it up, using your name, easy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which I'd never do because no one can say my name. So no. There's, doing it off the place, so like the street or the number of the building, or, you know, the name of the building, or that one,
like Herald Street Gallery, for
Herald
example,
Street, Frith Street,
or Frith Street Gallery,
47 Canal, exactly.
Yes.
So I would that's kind of an easy one that I'd probably go down at this point if I was to start all over again and make a new gallery. And then the third one is inventing your own name. And that can go one of two ways. It can either sound really cool, like Arcadia Missa, which now no one's going to think is cool because you made me explain what it bloody means. So thanks.
No, it's cooler.
I actually do think it's cool. And I think it's interesting because you were doing something different at that time, and it's still relevant and valid. So you don't need to feel bad for it. Because also, I always thought of Arcadia Missa as being this kind of institutional critique or something as well, it was kind of like creating a new.
You were never pursuing the art market, were you? Yeah, you weren't pursuing the art market. It's always been about institutional interest, and
exactly.
I think we have to hold on to our passions from when we're younger as well, because that's also who it's kind of like part of the DNA, who we are and why we are. And I don't know. I don't think there's anything to be embarrassed about.
Okay, well, you made me feel better. Thank you. Let's
Good.
See when
we
it
love
goes.
You. This is like
and everyone's just like, why did you tell them?
So we've done the history of the gallery. Where are
but
we
wait,
at now?
Wait, the other problem with the name, like making up a name, is it can be really, really bad. And when we go off recording, I'll give you some examples of it. Of the really bad. Okay.
The scandal. Oh my God, I love it.
It's great. Well, so where are we at now, like, for you? What is the art world, art market, institutions looking like now in the current climate? And
It's crazy. I'm hopeful that things will be all right business-wise, but what will... And that's just, you know, I need to stay positive in that sense, but what will fundamentally change is how people are accessing the art they're seeing or they're buying. Like, yes. You know, you're not... Like, how there are going to be restrictions, surely, for a very long time on... mass gatherings. Like, I don't know what an art fair is going to look like. Also, people are so much more conscious of how much flights they're taking. Are they going to want to fly around the world to go to an art fair? You know,
exactly.
Maybe
we've all been in that.
We've
all been in that WhatsApp group for galleries that a few London galleries helped set up, and we've all joined it. And I've found the responses that people have been discussing, like other gallerists, saying that actually, do we need to do an art fair in September or October, or do we need just to take a step back and focus on our direct community? Or
yeah, and just ensure that the openings at the gallery are like safe places for people to go and see art, and not
also
get
like not
virus.
Spending £50,000 or £30,000 or even £20,000, you know, up front on something where you're not even, you know,
which is what you have to put up if you want to do an art fair, right?
It's literally gambling. It's really crazy. And like the
well, listeners might not understand the whole process of that. So when you apply to be part of an art fair, you have to put up to 20 grand to 50 grand upwards to spend in, depending on the size of your booth up front.
Yeah,
like a year
before
in advance
the fair,
or something, don't you?
Well, there is start, like, I think like at one installment would be, you know, like a good, you know, maybe could be 9 months in advance or something. But
totally,
you have to pay before the fair. I mean, maybe a better model... to all the art fair directors out there, I think they're going to hate me for saying this, but like a different model could be that all of the sales are run through a system so that you actually know how many sales are happening, rather than like people having to have bravado and be like, yeah, great, made loads of contacts, like, yeah, place work, really good place, blah, blah, but actually running it through the fair and then just taking like a 5% cut of all the sales.
Yes, commission.
You know? Because
the thing about that would work is that it means the bigger galleries who are making millions, or at least a million, you know, from a fair or something, they would then be paying a sort of fairer share or something.
Yeah.
It's quite democratic, isn't it?
It's more democratic.
It's not democratic.
And it also just takes the gambling aspect out of it, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it's like if you sell nothing, you pay nothing.
Yeah, you have a bad fair and you've got that money.
Fine.
Yeah.
You know, there are people that have said, like, you know, gallery people that have had galleries before that have said to me, you know, like, yeah, we, you know, did Basel and we closed within a year after. You know, it was just
there's
such a hit.
There's been quite a few examples of that, I think, though. You know, of galleries, even with other art fairs, where a gallery finally gets into the art fair, they get there and you think it's finally your time, and then it's not.
Yeah,
I mean, I remember
totally.
When I started working with Carl Friedman, and he, for the first year, we just had that kind of financial crash in 2008, and I think it kind of extended through to 2009. And then I joined maybe 2010 kind of time, or 11, whatever. But I remember him still being incredibly cautious. And he wouldn't do, like, you know, five art fairs in a year. We did, like, one or two. And people at the time, all the collectors I knew were like, that's such a mistake. Like, why are you doing that? But actually, long term, it wasn't a mistake. Because
I think it'll be like that after this as well.
Because that's what I think people are starting to talk about now, though, aren't they? They're starting to say.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, yeah.
So the positive spin is that it's going to be a more democratic art world, hopefully.
Well, I don't know if it will be though, Russ. No. We would like it to be. You know, if we're going back to the
Arcadia
Missa
version.
Exactly. That's like our utopian dream. Yeah. Of what
I think maybe
will be, but the reality
maybe people
never really is
will
there, is
kind of, I don't know, engage like with the galleries they have locally. They maybe like will drop going to a couple of fairs a year and instead go to a few more openings in the city where they live. Which is nice.
Prior to all the internet though, a lot of collectors used to be loyal to certain galleries and support their roster, whereas now you have so many that people collect, and I'm a collector, so you collect in a broad bandwidth of galleries, whereas maybe it'd go back to like being really supportive of, you're saying, your local galleries, of like their roster and supporting their artists and supporting their program and their publishing and everything. If we can go back to that sort of world, that'd be really fantastic.
I mean, I'd love that. I would love that. I'd cut out some of my travel, you know, save the planet a bit more. What else? You know, I think that, I don't know, again, kind of build that local community more. I mean, it's also not, maybe it's not viable because we're all in touch with everyone all over the world online all the time. We'll see. Like, also the other thing that's happening is the kind of like surge in this idea of viewing, online viewing rooms and all of that.
How do you find them yourself?
I'm still in the stage of scrambling to try and find out if, you know, what support's out there. So I can't really think that far ahead to online viewing rooms. I think what's nice is we're actually going to like put all of our publications as e-publications from the website today. So like that's more our online thing that we're doing at the moment is like, yeah, the content of the publications is more available. But the
and that's free online... or do people like...
No.
Well, that's fine. No. That's fair enough because it costs to publish them. So yeah.
Exactly. No, but it's not that expensive. And we did metabolize If Able, which is a great novella by Clay AD at the start of the week. And that was a pay what you can donation. And that is for the Crit Fund. So that's a fundraiser for helping people with disabilities during Corona. So, you know, getting like help for delivering of food, for hand sanitizer, for all sorts of stuff. That is our fundraiser that we did. And
that's great. So you're getting a bit of culture and you're helping the world and you're helping your community.
Yeah. And then I think we'll going forward, like as we do the e-publications, like I think some will be, you know, to maintain gallery income, and then we'll see where we are in a few weeks, and maybe others will be for other fundraisers. We're not really sure yet. But at the moment, actually, the publications are a form of income that's still happening because the publications manager, she has stock at her house and can do the online postage thing, so actually... post book, the physical books as well as these online ones.
Can you just say what your website address is, because the listeners can then check out your website and see these publications and buy them if they want.
It's arcadiamissa.com.
Perfect. And you have a shop, don't you, actually, on the website?
Yeah So there's some editions and there's some books. And
is it expensive to publish a book?
Well, we do it really cheaply because the design is done in-house, and we use a print-on-demand service, so we'll only print a few hundred at first of an edition, the first edition.
We were talking about doing a book, weren't we, with Hannah Quillen and Rosie Hastings?
Exactly, yeah.
Would it be one of these in-house ones?
No, that would be much more like with the institutions for the show and much more like a catalogue. Nice. And that's more the traditional mode of publishing, where probably like a few thousand would be printed at the start, you know?
It's so expensive though, isn't it? It can be like tens of thousands of pounds.
The way we've done it in this much more DIY publishing arm of the gallery is that, you do like, you know, you could do the first edition of only 100. And then when they sell, you print another 100, you know?
Yeah, amazing,
And do it like that to keep the cost down. But to do a big catalogue like with a museum, that is a lot more expensive for sure.
Talking about DIY, that's something I really wanted to chat to you a bit about, because I constantly get, since we've been doing talk art, more and more and more messages from young artists saying, how do I get my first exhibition? How do I do it? You know, how do I get a museum to see my work, or how do I get a collector to want to collect my work? You know, I'm getting daily messages from artists. When you're running a gallery, you get the like we get it at Carl Friedman Gallery, where you get lots of submissions, even if you have a no submissions policy, because people are just, you know, really wanting to be seen, which I totally respect and understand. But the trouble is, we don't always have time to even look after the artists we have, if you know what I mean. Like,
yeah.
To then have to look at hundreds of people's artworks on top of
it's
it.
It's just not possible.
Isn't possible time-wise, or it's just humanly not possible, sadly, unless you hired someone full-time just to look at submissions or something. But I've always said to people, like, connect with your other friends and artists and try and put on shows together and stuff like that.
Yes.
And this idea of peer validation is such a kind of key thing for me that I think has been one of your biggest successes, is that instead of wanting the approval of the outside art world, you just wanted the approval of your peers in a way. Not approval, but you wanted to be connected to your peers.
Yeah,
can you talk a bit about that and how that, and the artists that you then took on that were part of that thing?
Well, me and Jesse Darling were in the same year at CSM.
Love Jesse and Darling.
Central St. Martin's.
They're amazing. And, you know.
You trained as an artist, right?
Yeah, I studied fine art, and got my degree, but from the off, like, immediately got a space and wanted to do that and never made work ever again.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
And that was at St. Martin's?
Yeah. And it was funny because me and Jesse, like, we really weren't very popular, you know? Like, it's not like we were in the popular, like, crews. So it's quite, I don't know, we found each other. We were in the same, because I was in 2D pathway and Jesse was in 3D pathway. But then we were in the same historical and theoretical classes, and we just...
What is that? You're going to have to explain what that is, because I don't know what any of that means.
Art theory, but the thing is, it was only French post-structuralists. And it was like men, like white men, and it was taught by this kind of like middle-aged white man, and me and Jesse were just like, this is rubbish, man. You know, like, just complete, like, whatever about it. And I mean, obviously... there's obviously, like, a lot of great theory in that, but it was just very narrow. Jesse is amazing and is one of the kind of only people that, like, we maintained a friendship after uni, and obviously that friendship is also a working relationship. And
what's that like? Has that ever been tested when it comes
to work? Of course, man. Because, like, you know, it's like, sometimes you're wanting to have a conversation as friends. Sometimes it needs to be just work. Sometimes, you know, emotions, like, on a kind of interpersonal level, come in to the work conversation. You know, like, of course. But I think that it's also means that there's a lot of solidarity in the work relationship, even, you know, even if it means that it can be, like, more emotional at times. And yeah, there was a couple of other artists in other years at CSM that are part of the roster. And I mean, the thing of peer led, like Hannah Quinlan and Rosie Hastings, they're the youngest artists on my roster. I call them the toddlers.
Everybody knows I love them. I'm their biggest fan.
I am their biggest
fan.
And if listeners haven't heard their episode yet, we've already interviewed them, and it was one of the best interviews we ever did. I love them.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Art, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, yeah, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser's also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and talk art with Sir Peter Blake. Yes. I mean, yeah. they currently have a show up now, which no one's able to see at Focal Point Gallery in Essex.
But it's going to travel to a lot of other places. So hopefully people will be able to see it when it travels.
But what does that feel like now for people? I mean, there's so many people that have got shows up that are being hung.
It's heartbreaking for a lot of people, I think. It really is. Penny Goring, one of the artists I work with.
I love Penny Goring. She's on my list of things I wanted to talk to you about.
Amazing. Well, we went to Paris and hung the show in masks and gloves. Oh. And then, like, in a day, and then escape back to London. It's heartbreaking. But
what's going to happen? Is that going to get deinstalled and then just shipped back, or can they just push the dates on?
No one can make plans about that now.
I don't think people can decide yet, can they? Because it's so complicated as well. If you think about somewhere like, on a big scale, if you think about a museum like Tate, they've currently got that Warhol show. And partly why they have that show will be to increase book sales. It will be to increase, you know, postcard sales in their store, to increase visitor numbers so that they can keep getting their grants, all those kind of things. So they actually have to plan these shows strategically, you know, really on a bigger scale. It's very different to what you and I are doing.
But does it just follow the diaristic dates that were set before?
People can't make decisions, but I think a lot of things will get extended so that there is a chance for people to get to the galleries. Like,
and maybe we just have
to rethink our pace, you know. We really have to rejig everything. Like, it's we need to really think about how much do we really need to be doing, you know, like what's the cost and the consequences, and what are our priorities?
In what way though? What do you mean? How much do we need to be doing in what way?
Like, do we need to, like, there's this amazing text by Hito Steil called The Terror of Total Design, you know, I can't say that word. But anyway, she talks about the art world's need for presence, right? And the currency that comes with being at the opening by, you know, going, like, talking at the panel, like, all of this stuff. And there is a currency that with that, and it's still within a system, an art system, where very few are making a really load of money and everyone else, a lot of artists, are living below the poverty line. Do you know what I mean? So, yeah. So if it is creating this currency, and still it's not that wealth that's created by presence is not being evenly distributed. So, and then even more so, it's like, okay, and it's also part of like destroying the planet and spreading a virus everywhere. How much do we need to be doing that, you know? So I think that there are, not just us thinking about how the business works and all of this stuff of like just surviving, I think that a lot of people are rethinking their priorities, and it's quite nice because you can be like, okay, that's a shame I have to cut this and this and this fair and that, but like actually, oh, what's really good is if I can stay open, keep the business going, I can do this show with this amazing artist.
Yeah.
And what if I just do 4 shows a year? Like, okay, that's real change, but at least I get to work with these artists and show this work, you know? Like, okay, I haven't traveled around doing this, that, and the other.
Priorities are shifting, basically.
Totally.
Yeah.
And it becomes it comes back to what fundamentally we're all in it for is the art.
Yeah, because everything can fall, really. Like, all these other things that we do and we feel, like, obliged to do, we realise we don't. And then it means that the things that you find yourself refusing to let go of are your core things, and it's like, okay, yeah, you know, the shows are still going to happen in the gallery, you know.
That's also the, I was talking to an artist the other day who's been making work for a show. It's not actually a show that's you know, being postponed currently, but she was saying that for her, if it had been her, you know, that had a show postponed, because she still might, because it was meant to be September, and we've got no idea right now if that will still happen or not. Yeah. But she was just happy that she'd even made the work, because even if it doesn't get seen in September, that work wouldn't have existed if she hadn't been working towards that show.
Yeah.
And
I think what she was saying is that in a way, it doesn't matter whether she gets an audience right now, because even in 100 years, at least she still made that work, because it was actually quite progressive, incredible part of her work, and she's aged probably like early 50s, so for her it's like a time where she feels like getting excited, pushed her into doing something new. And I feel like if you look at Hannah and Rosie, I mean, that's their first institutional show at Focal Point, and the focus and precision of what they've produced, and the incredible work they've made, it's like it was worth it just for that. Do you know what I mean?
And like the breadth of things, fresco, like to decide to do we've never painted before, I know, we'll make a fresco. Like, when would they wouldn't do that in their studio for fun.
When,
like,
we interviewed them, they were just about to go and learn
exactly
to do
rose
it.
To the occasion. Yeah,
they were just when we did our interview, they then traveled off straight away afterwards to go and learn how to paint frescoes.
So cute.
And then came back. It was just like, what do you look for in artists? How do you find artists, and what is your kind of, what gets your goat with artists?
Yeah,
and you go, yes.
I mean, I guess this goes back to the thing you were saying, Rob, about like actually a lot of people, you know, kind of saying, you know, how can I get representation and that stuff, and like Hannah and Rosie, like I was saying, they were doing their own events. So like you were saying, this DIY thing, they were doing at gay bar events, like the parties, the reading groups in their bed. And like, that's how I came across their work. Like, it's not like, they just graduated from BA. I didn't go to the BA show at Goldsmiths. Like, I didn't pick them up from that. Like, because they were, you know, creating their own community and presenting their work to their peers in that way, that's how I came across their work. And I think that there's that, but the core of it was that there was like a real, you could see like an authenticity, like they were doing it because they really wanted, these were the themes they were interested in, this was what the research they were like obsessed with, you know. And like, I think that there's not one type of art that I'm like, this is my thing. I just think that if you, like, why, I don't know why we should give so much. Like, if I think about my politics, the idea that I would be give so much kind of attention and value to one individual's expression doesn't maybe marry so well. But actually, if what that person is saying is something that a lot of people can identify with or feel, but ultimately is something that they are genuinely saying, like, if we're going to focus on an individual's expression, it has to be a real one. Like, it really has to come from like what they truly are interested in, what they truly believe, what they, you know, they truly want to say, and like what they just happen to make. Like, it can't be contrived. And I've done a lot of teaching in art schools, and I, and like, you know, there are some people that aren't, you know, overthinking it too much of like, oh, you know, maybe I should do this, or I should be talking about that, or I should be making that. They're like, they are, you know, it can be conceptual art and there's a load of research. They can be makers, but it's something that is extremely honest, and because they just have to do it, they want to do it. And that's that. And that's why I can care about what an individual's saying, you know, because it's authentic. So that really, I guess, is the main thing.
You definitely have a roster of very distinct voices. If you think of like Raber Mabry or Penny Goring, Amalia, as you mentioned earlier, Amalia Ullman, like you have these very strong voices that have a, you know, to take a stance, I guess, but it's their stance, it's their reality.
Yeah.
But I think those people identity. Will bring about social change as well. It's
yeah.
a great
Yeah. Thing, so. Shall I? Well, because of Penny, you know, because Penny's show never even had an opening, never had even a day of public open, her show at Campoli Presti in Paris, everyone should look at it. But shall I read the poem that's the press release that she wrote?
Yes.
It's so good.
And I loved Penny Goring's show in didn't you do it in Peckham?
Focus. You did the Focus as well, didn't you?
Yeah, because I came to see that show. Yeah. And I loved that show. So.
Yeah, so she's so good. I won't be able to read it as well as she can read her poems, but I'll give it a go. Okay. Two lovers escape from Blood Castle. There is no escape from Blood Castle. No escape from confinement or control or eternity, opium, poison, or lucky in an unlucky way. Thrill to the blah, 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 anything. Look to the stars and the mud. Try disappearing. Pray to be rescued or profoundly forgotten. Or groveling for the very slim chance. Crawl into ruined old age. Confess petty crimes in the garden. Bolt for your freedom while limping. Or run with your broken heart thumping. Or sharp pointy sticks in your eyes. The mechanisms of safety are weaponized. Every process designed to do harm, no secret corners to huddle or failing to cope or extreme naked yoga or laughing in an unlucky way, upside down, kissing your fingers, plague bones. It hasn't been fun for ages. Your face on swarm girl, kitchen sinking, red hand, grey sky, meets your ankles. We break your legs and carry you to the block on a very ornate chair. A very ornate chair stuffed with saints' hair and your fingernails, because you asked for it, because the crowd wants it, because it was decreed in our walls. The ghost of scratching Susan told us her lies are the greatest. This is what she says. Blah, 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 anything. My poor darling, anything. Storm fruit, panic cell, blossom bitch, blood show, ghost tourist, devil scammer, fibbing driver, knife buzz, hip flask, bigger bijou, mercy fucker, bag bird, golden bollocks, future bacon, abstract gamble, caps lock, darker matter, deeper lotion, toxic circus, death toll, see-through nylon, disco stripper, fever flowers, bomb drop, bloody castle, dolly motion, sugar window, clock stop, blah, 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 anything, poison on your tongue. How good is that?
Oh my God.
Amazing. Isn't she incredible?
Yeah, you read that so well. Do you know what it makes me think of is Sarah Kane, who was a playwright who took her own life years and years ago, but she's been at the Royal Court. She was like discovered there and did these incredible plays like Crave and Blast, and they're really, and like Edward Bond as well, it makes me think of. Do you know these playwrights that are very social?
I don't know.
Good playwrighty person, I'm afraid.
Right. Well, that's my theatre thing then. If you look them
up,
read Sarah Kane, because the parallels between her poetry and Sarah Kane's writing is like, that is, it just brings me straight back to that. It's very visceral and very raw and scary in some ways. Yeah. Things that are being said, you're like, it's kind of delving into the depths of humanity, the dark side of humanity, the underbelly, but we all, and our own fears. Wow, that was amazing.
Yeah. You should hear, like, imagine Penny reading it, man, though. Like, seriously, so good. Everyone
needs to
check.
How did you find her work?
I'd love to talk to Penny at some point.
Incredible. You've got to talk to Penny. She's literally, like...
She British?
She lives in Surbiton, so she's, like, still London, essentially.
I first saw her work with you in Switzerland.
Yeah, yeah.
Wasn't it Switzerland?
I think so. Listen, well, no, we did.
It was
no,
no,
it must
not,
have,
not,
no,
not
it must have been
fair.
Peckham.
It was in
you
somebody's.
Saw it for...
It was in somebody's.
Oh, in Harry Burke's group show at Salts.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
That was Switzerland, wasn't it, Basel?
Yeah. That was
but
the
it wasn't
group
the
show
art
at Salts.
Because I remember you were there at the opening, and I saw
exactly.
some little drawings, and you were like,
yeah, Penny.
You were going to love her, and then that's why I got into it, and then I came to your show later in Peckham.
Yes, exactly. She's incredible. Like I was. Obviously, because we do publishing, I was following a lot of like alt lit writers online and stuff in, I don't know, 2012 or whatever.
Exactly,
she was posting.
What does alt lit stand for?
Well, it's kind of problematic now because it turned out a lot of these alt lit poets were, you know, basically very Me Too-ish and gross. And so the whole scene kind of collapsed because of that. But there was a whole online community of poets. And
it just means alternative literature.
It means alternative right. literature. And she was posting a lot of image macros and poetry online, and just was. So I knew her through, I guess, like social networks that were intersecting with all this old lit stuff. And she was posting a lot of stuff on this website that now doesn't work called New Hive, which right. is really. I can send you. Like, we managed to screen record some of this website. So it's all, like, GIFs and videos and, like, I don't know, you're clicking through and that's how you're accessing the poetry, but it's also very visual. Like, anyway, she's incredible. And so I just thought all of these alt-lit poets were kind of, like, I don't know, some of them were teenagers, you know, they're young. So I assumed that because also her stuff was, like, so raw, so fresh, so amazing. Like, I just assumed, yeah, that she was
a millennial. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually she, you know, her and my mum were born in the same year. Like there's an amazing self-portrait she's done of like in like 2008 of herself as like Ziggy Stardust. Like she's like, oh, wow. She's lived through so many decades, but yeah. actually like everything she does is just timeless, but also of the moment, yeah. which is another good, if a good artist is always that, you know, always timeless, but still always contemporary or something like that, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And so it was through her poetry. And then me and Julia Smith and Alice Brooke did this kind of curatorial project across the showroom in the ICA called Rematerializing Feminism. And it was a response to a lot of the kind of like, this was in 2014, like kind of popularization of feminism, or like internet feminisms or those kind of words, but putting it through like Marxist materialist discourse to see if maybe like actually if we talk about things in terms of like the structure of capitalism or labor, that's a way to have intersectional conversations, you know, feminist ones, but identity politics in general. Mm-hmm. And we showed a video of Penny's, and then from there that's how I really got to know her as an artist. So at first I really knew her as a poet, but then getting to know her through that, and then yeah, she's just, I mean, everything she makes is incredible. Like I've never, like it's going to her place and seeing, you know, there's years of sketchbooks, like it's, she's just phenomenal. Mm-hmm. So everyone needs to check her out.
What is identity politics? We're talking about that.
Oh,
that
God.
Is like talking about colour, queerness, if you're like your gender, your rights.
Oh, it's actually kind of annoying. It's a kind of an annoying term, actually.
But in a nutshell, identity politics is about what it is to be human and how the gaze of everybody's gaze is on you.
Yeah, I guess it's like to be othered and kind of like how you exist in the world because of how you are read by others or by society at large, I guess.
Right.
But it is, it can be problematic and I guess especially curatorially used as a way to ghettoize artists or to put the artist at the forefront in front of the work and not allow the work to kind of stand on its own.
Got it.
So it's tricky and...
It's grouping yeah. artists into certain things like artists of colour or queer artists or female artists. Is it that sort of thing?
Yes, and that's why it can be problematic because you can have someone making completely different work and just because, you know, they're
just
queer.
They're female.
They're put into a show and it's like, and maybe there's not actually like any connection between the practices, you know. But it can be done well, but it can be done badly. So
it's a loose linear, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, I think Hannah Black's text called, what's it called? The Identity Artist and the Identity Critic is a really good critique of identity politics and how it's kind of operates or is maybe exploited within the art world, I guess. Because it's also, it can be used as a really good way of organizing, a really good kind of way like to self-organize, you know, for struggle and to connect with other oppressed groups. Or it can also be too, like, it can hold one back, or it's tricky. It's a,
it helps you to rally in some ways,
but yes, exactly,
yeah,
but it can
rally the troops.
You can also end up ghettoized by being grouped. You know.
Okay, so nice question. You could have any artist, and you could put a show on in your gallery in the world, historical, dead or alive, you know, the estate of or someone now. Who would it be?
This is the worst question. Obviously, all the artists I represent, for one.
Yes, but you've given them all a show. You've given every single one of them a show, amazing blockbuster show. They've just been bought by every institution in the world. And then you have a space at the end of the year where you have 2 months where you can choose any artist you want ever.
Oh, shit.
And you could do a show. What would it be?
Should I just tell you what I've been looking at
lot
at the moment that is outside of what I would normally show because it's old, if you get what I mean?
Got it.
I've been looking at Ithil Colquhoun. She was a painter, poet, surrealist. It's just basically a new female surrealist artist that I didn't know about until, I don't know, last year.
Is she French? Where's her
name British, from? British.
British?
Yeah.
How do you spell it?
I-T-H-E-L-L and then...
Sorry, start again?
I-T-H-E-L-L and then her surname is... Colquhoun.
Oh, wow. These are beautiful.
Aren't they incredible?
So, was she ignored or was she known and disappeared? Or
I think
what was
her
story?
I mean, I think just like most female artists, she'd probably be more well known if she was a man, basically.
That's got to be my drag name. That's my drag name going forward. They're going to be like, welcome to the stage.
Maybe it's Ithil as well. I love Ithil. Her.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, I'm so glad you mentioned this. And she died in 1988.
Yeah, so that's actually...
Quite recent,
yeah.
So why could you not show her work? Because you're...
No, I probably could. I mean, I probably could. But there's so many artists I'd love to show. Like this, even like young artists, like this is the thing of, you know, it having to be a business or how much human time is possible. Like there's, you don't have enough time to show all the artists you want. And that's, like I said earlier, why it's great that there's publications, because at least there's a little bit of a platform for other artists that I don't represent as well. But like there's so many good artists, like, and it's hard because there's... I think
we're in a good time for emerging artists at the moment, in Britain especially, UK.
Yeah, definitely. Rini Matic,
yes.
She's great. And all the degree shows are getting cancelled, right? So
that's right.
I know,
they're all
going, we've been getting emails.
They're trying to do virtual ones, aren't they? Yeah,
it's crazy.
So she was supposed to be, well, she still will be graduating, I'm guessing, from CSM, but she is like... so leaps and bounds ahead of where most art students are, like in terms of their practice when they're finishing school. So she's definitely someone that I was excited. I don't normally go to BA shows, but I was really excited to see her BA show.
Good tip, hot tip.
So going on to our normal traditional talk art questions. If you could,
she's already asked me such
heist.
A nightmare. Yeah.
If you could do an art heist and take home any artwork, what would you steal?
So this one I actually did think about before, and I realised that, I don't know why, because there are a lot of makers that are thinkers as well, but your brain kind of sees, you know, you see some artists like, you know, thinking art and some artists kind of making art. And when you think of something you want to steal, you're kind of thinking of owning something and you're going, and like, I was going more towards like, yeah, like painting basically, which is weird because, you know, I show a lot of video and all of that. It was kind of, I was like, oh, like it's still inbuilt in me, kind of like I would want to own painting. So I thought, okay, I'm not going to go for it. Because also, how can you choose? There's so many like famous paintings that you'd steal. Yeah. And then I just thought, actually, I'm just going to do a shout out to Hungarian performance artists because there probably won't be many Hungarian artists mentioned. So I thought I'd shout out Katalin Ladik.
Awesome.
So she did some like really cool screamy performance art in the 60s and 70s. And I love
that stuff.
And the other thing is that you can't really own performance art. Like that she does, obviously there's photography of hers, like documentation, but I just kind of thought also at that time, like when you can't really, like, I wonder what it would be like. The audience is so integral to performance art now, like the play or like the play with the audience or the knowledge of the gaze of the audience, like with someone like Arne Imhoff or something, it works so well within the performance. Whereas in the 60s and the 70s, like performance art was really in its infancy. So I do wonder kind of what it actually felt like seeing that without the structure of, you know, the gallery and you're the audience and this is how you view performance art. So it'd be kind of cool to be able to own that. But the ownership of a performance by Katalin Ladik would be to actually have been able to be there. Amazing. Do you know what I mean?
Well, you know that Sadie Coles chose Gilbert and George's The Singing Sculpture. That was one of her like art heists. That was like to experience that, to have that to yourself, your own little kind of thing would be amazing.
And also we spoke to Rufus Wainwright, the musician, last night for this series, and he mentioned having met Jack Smith, who was the kind of pioneer in New York of performance art. We were talking about that idea that a lot of people might not even know Jack Smith because there is the work that is left over isn't, you know, the performances aren't there anymore.
Yeah, so it's, they're not
unless
there.
They're really well documented at the time. It's a really interesting thing.
There's a lot of cool Thek work that was lost as well, wasn't there?
Oh, I love
that. Oh, I know.
But that's about what you're saying now about like the narrative of actually being present at these things rather than just being recorded and seeing them is what it is to experience art. That currency of actually being there and feeling that room.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's why, you know, the online viewing rooms, they're never going to be a proper stand-in for an exhibition, you know.
It did make me laugh, you know, somebody did a meme on Instagram that was like, has no one actually worked out that online viewing rooms are actually just websites?
I was like, good one.
And now you've got a username and a password given to you that makes you feel special and then you might spend money because of it. I mean, it is kind of ridiculous on that level, but at the same time,
I guess we've got to do something. Yeah, of course. And like, you know, it's also for the artists, like you've had these plans of like giving them a show, giving them a platform, and then you can't. Like, you want to do whatever you can to be able to promote the work.
Who's worked with artists who are like digital culture anyway, like for a long time or you know, using the internet.
That's why it's so sad that the new Hive website doesn't work anymore with all Penny's like, you know, amazing poetries and stuff. Like there are just poetries, but there are so many.
It's plural. There's a lot.
Poetries. The arts. There are artists that could really use online platforms and make something that like is a really, really engaging experience. But I think for now, everyone's just trying to be like, okay, what's our stand-in for the show or the fair we had planned? And because it is essentially a website and we like have images on the website and stuff, and I'm just trying to scramble around to figure out a whole bunch of other shit right now. That I think that's why we just prioritize, okay, let's just try and make as many of the publications, e-publications, as quickly as possible, you know? And then we're going to have a real look and a think and look at all the different online viewing rooms and kind of see if it's worth it once that's calmed down a bit. But I think the, you know, the immediate thing of like, if you're reading a book on a tablet or a physical book, the difference is a lot smaller to an exhibition in a gallery and an online viewing room. Doing the books immediately, we're like, EPUBs are great. You're experiencing the content because you're reading it. Great, do it. Let's make them as quickly as possible.
Amazing. And hopefully people listening to this actually have more time to read as well. So
yeah, and they should definitely go and check out the website.
That's also good.
This,
yay
yeah.
for podcasts.
So, Rojka, what is your, the other hard-hitting talk art question, what is your favourite colour and why?
My favourite colour is, well, I've got two. My favourite, and also, you know how on this, like, the artists are so good, they're like, oh, this soft kind of, and they almost describe a texture and a really specific colour. I don't have that. My favourite colour is purple because it was my favourite colour as a kid and I only used to wear purple, and it's that kind of, like, you know, Collie Street or Roses, that kind of purple, like proper
purple.
That
was always my favourite chocolate. Oh,
that
my God.
Chocolate. He's got hazelnut in it, I think.
I always went for the purple one.
Yeah, exactly. This Cadbury's Dairy Milk purple, because I always used to wear purple and my aunt would call me Purple Princess. However, you've got to also give Red a shout out, because, like,
say that again. Your aunt used to call you Purple Princess.
She called me Purple Princess because I refused to wear any other colour for about 2 years. Purple has been like, purple is like number one colour for a long time.
Then the other colour you said was?
The other colour, you've got to give Red a shout out because it's just great. And my favourite red is Postbox Red. Or like actually maybe slightly more orangey than Postbox Red. Like so bright.
Cadbury's purple and Postbox Red. Very solid, very like they know themselves.
I love those two colours together. Yeah. If you have red and purple, like that kind of red with purple.
That's me. Like, that's me in 50 together. Years. You know, I'm going to be in all those two colours constantly. I'm going to have like 27 animals, probably like growing all sorts in my back garden. Like that's, I can see my future
is
now.
Is that a euphemism or is that?
No. I'll just start this look now. Like I've got time to start researching
the purple princess
all my purple
back.
And red. Yeah.
So we got one more question.
That'll be the look that you're remembered for as well.
Exactly.
Like, you know what I mean? That'll be
the crazy old lady in purple and red.
You're going to be like an inspiration.
Yeah.
Yes. Royal Mail. So we've got the last question we ask is what have you found out is your hidden lockdown talent?
This is a Quarantine special question.
Nothing, man. I don't have.
I think it sounds like you've been too busy having to like negotiate.
I've just been freaking out and trying to find all information that the government hasn't given the details of yet, and on the phone constantly to the council and like. So my hidden talent, is like maybe managing to to keep doing that. In the face of
responding
like
to a crisis,
despair.
Calmly.
Yeah.
And what about teaching technology to the older generations?
Exactly.
Bringing podcasts to the OAPs of Roxley.
There we go. Bringing the OAPs to talk art.
I'm so happy you're with your grandma because
young people
at the moment aren't able to be with their families because they were too late in getting to them.
So yeah, I know. So and it was so really funny. Early. I went really early and also I spent like over a week like refusing to be in the same room as her and like self-isolating stuff and being really extra. Well, and now it's calmed down and it's like, okay, we're actually like, she's on one sofa, I'm on the other, we're watching telly together. It's so nice. I'm so relieved. I feel so sorry for everyone that's having to quarantine on their own.
It must be
so brutal. Oh, I'm so
luckily,
sorry.
The thing about this is for me is that I'm totally fine because I live alone anyway. And it's like having talk art and getting these conversations is keeping me encouraged.
And you're on Instagram Live at the minute, Rob. Every 10 minutes.
Well, I was for 30 days. But there was this really great article today that some friends sent us in The Guardian about a writer in Italy about what the experience has been for her. And it's a letter to kind of people in England. And a few of our friends were crying reading it today. Russ actually had a tear. I didn't want to say it was him, but he did have a tear. Yeah. reading it. It's really wonderfully
simple. I don't mind
admitting
I'm emotional.
No, I know. You're an incredibly emotional being. Yeah. We're doing things like baking tonight. So all of our friends are going to bake cookies. And our friend Sarah Hadlin, who's an actor and a very funny human being, she's guiding all of us. So I've been going through all my cupboards trying to find ingredients for baking
ingredients.
Cookies. But I'm loving that. So I don't feel alone at all. I'm so lucky to have amazing friends.
We're busier more than ever. Especially now.
No problem. Thanks for having me. But like when you emailed and you were like, can you do 11 on Saturday? And I was like, well, no, because I actually have Lisa Bangs is doing her online fitness. And so actually I'm busy at that time. Like we're still busy.
I've just had a yoga mat delivered as well, which I've never had.
I need to do that. Literally, I was doing this HIIT class this morning on the carpet and my hands are raw. So I need one.
Well, I tried to do some online yoga on a rug and ended up just like burning my skin. So I was like, okay, I have to get a yoga mat. I've always resisted having a yoga mat. I think for some weird reason
now you're one of those people.
The world, but
Roja, quick fire question. Best thing about being a dealer?
Oh, getting to work with artists.
The worst thing about being a dealer.
having to work with artists. No, I'm joking.
Perfect.
Let's leave it at that. That's genius. No.
Okay.
Well, we love you. Thank you so much
me.
For coming on.
Lots that of love.
Awesome. And
stay in touch.
We'll be yes, posting images on our Instagram at TalkArt of all the artists we've mentioned today. And please visit arcadiamissa.com and check out the incredible
at
publications
and ebooks. On Instagram.
Speak soon, guys. Stay safe. Lots of love.
Lots of love. Bye.
Mwah.
Mwah.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamant and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Marc Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president. You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Marc.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.